welcome back from the movement meditation. So I'm going to offer a couple of teachings that the Buddha gave about compasses for navigating the path of practice with wisdom. And the first is based on a discourse in the numerical discourses. Basically, the discourse's name is the name of a town, Kesaputta. And the way the discourse opens up says the Buddha was a wandering sage, basically, right? He was a teacher in ancient India. And as you might be aware, ancient India had a lot of teachers. It was a religiously pluralistic, very diverse society. And the Buddha, though, had a reputation, a very good reputation, as a wise sage. And one day he happens along this town, Kesaputta, which is in the heart of the teaching circuit, so to speak. Right? The folks in this town, the Kalamas, see a lot of teachers day to day, week to week. It's kind of the social media and entertainment and news of their day, these wandering bards and teachers. The only thing is, each of these teachers seems to be building up their own version of what's right and tearing down everyone else's. This might sound a little bit familiar from current state of affairs. So the Kalamas are perplexed, doubtful. They're about fed up, actually. They're fed up. By the time the Buddha comes along and hearing that he's wise, they're ready to ask a good question. How on earth do we figure out which of these teachers and doctrines are worth listening to and which we should disregard? Now I'm going to put it in the language that Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it. What he says is, they're saying, we are perplexed and in doubt, Bhante. Bhante is teacher. As to which of these good ascetics speak truth and which speak falsehood. Now the Buddha replies to them, it is fitting for you to be perplexed and in doubt, Kalamas. Fitting. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. In other words, this is kind of tough. And he goes on to say some of the things that they should not rely on when ascertaining whether or not a teacher or a teaching is worth relying on. Do not go by oral tradition. Do not go by lineage of teaching. Don't go by hearsay or common talk. And don't even go by a collection of scriptures like the one I have in my hand. In other words, don't go by something someone tells you to be true, even if it's been handed down by oral tradition, even if it's in books. And don't even trust a teaching because it happens to belong to a lineage that you resonate with or belong to. Or because it's in lots of books. He even said, not to rely on the seeming competence or charisma of the teacher. Okay, so how many of you are familiar with this story? Can I get a few? A few, right? Okay. So, many of you have heard the punchline by now. The Buddha tells people to look inside themselves to ascertain the validity of a teaching, right? It's in the spirit of free inquiry, deciding for yourself what is or is not valid in any spiritual teaching, Buddhism included. That is often the message people draw from this discourse. But it's only partly true. The Buddha told these people they should know for themselves whether or not a teaching was for them. That's accurate. However, he didn't just lead them without a compass. In fact, while he encouraged them to use their discernment, he specifically called out some things within their own minds, things within our own minds that we should not rely on. Yes. I'm using a different translation now, just to sort of highlight possibilities. This comes from Gil Fronstall. Do not go by oral tradition, a teaching lineage, common talk, scripture, or logic, intuition, reasoning, or even by pondering. So what's left? Any ideas?
What is?
Okay. Your heart? Great. Any others?
Your own experience.
Your own experience, yes. As long as you leave out those things.
Does it work?
What does and doesn't work? Mm-hmm. Great. So the Buddha actually offers a list as well of criteria that can be used in the absence of logical thought, reasoning, pondering, intuition, and all those other things. Though boiling it down to what's in your heart and direct experience is a pretty good way to go. He offers a list of pairs. The first pair is what's wholesome or unwholesome, kusala or akusala in the Pali. Another translation is skillful or unskillful. Now, this is a powerful method of practice in my own experience. And some very prominent teachers would say that noticing what's wholesome and unwholesome is all you need. Noticing in your heart what's wholesome and unwholesome is all you need to discern and cultivate fruitful practice. In this context, though, for now, I'm going to leave it very simple. Does it pass a gut check? Does this teaching pass a gut check or a heart check? In some ways, the next four criteria the Buddha introduces could be considered elaborations on this one. So the next two pairs are, is it blameworthy or blameless? And is it censured or praised by the wise? So I think of these two pairs as being mindfulness of a slightly broader scope, mindfulness of context, if you will. These both exist, as you might notice, within the realm of our cultural conditioning. What's blameworthy or blameless, or what the wise will or will not get behind. However, we still need an internal reference point of some kind, right? So one is an innate sense of fairness or lack of fairness. This is an internal reference point, by the way, that we share with other primates. Maybe some of you have heard a story about the capuchin monkeys. Experimenters did a test on capuchins. This was a while back. And all these monkeys were sort of together in a giant lab. You know, they could see each other. They were behind cage doors, but they could see each other. And the experimenter each day would have a monkey do a trick and then feed it a cucumber. And always peaceful. Until one day, one monkey got the cucumber as usual, and the second monkey got grapes. Yeah, we all know what happens then, right? It's not good. The second monkey takes one look at the one who got the grapes, looks at his cucumber in absolute disbelief, and hurls it back at the experimenter. So, rather than taking what he could get, he was so angry about the lack of fairness that he gave up what he had. But it's an all too human response. That's why we laugh, right? So that innate sense of fairness, I believe, is something that we can draw on, to get a sense of whether something is blameworthy or blameless, right? Somewhere in us, we already know this doesn't seem quite right. This is off. Other internal reference points might be, is there kindness or cruelty here? Is there integrity or lack of integrity? Is there honesty or habitual deception at work? Check out the teaching. Check out the teacher. Find out. And what about censured or praised by the wise? This is totally external, isn't it? It's societal rather than the internal, knowing for yourselves that the Buddha says he's teaching the koans. Well, let's see. One way to consider censure or praise by the wise is that we can reflexively rely on what psychologists call social proof. Have any of you heard this term before? So it's the idea that if a bunch of people find something interesting, worth paying attention to, or good, we are more likely to find it the same way. And I think it was sociologists that did this study where they planted two people on a city corner and had them just stare up at the top corner of a building. Nothing was going on. Nothing at all. But what do you think happened within 5 or 10 minutes? Yes, you've got a whole group staring up at the top of this building where there's nothing going on. So that's social proof. We can rely on something a little bit better than that, right? So, and well, also social proof can backfire, come to think of it, pretty badly at times, right? Crowds are not known for their intelligence, shall we say. So, perhaps it's worth attending to a very important internal reference point as well. We need some wisdom, I believe, in order to recognize the wisdom in others. Some part of us already gets it. Maybe we don't get it completely, maybe we don't totally know why that person is wise, but they speak to some bigger part of ourselves. And avoiding censure for what such people, from such people, can be a combination of self-respect and deep respect in them as well. The last two pairs that the Buddha teaches the Kalamas are the ones he emphasizes the most. It continues to ripple throughout the rest of the teaching. And those are, does this lead to harm or welfare? And is it conducive to suffering or to happiness? So those are pretty distilled, right? Kind of cut to the pith of the matter. I think of these as mindfulness of consequences. It's mindfulness over time, in other words, a kind of mindfulness that can mature into wisdom. The Buddha repeatedly emphasized these two pairs of criteria in a particular way as well, a way that's associated with the growth of wisdom and awakening in these early teachings. He asked people to notice the presence or absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. And he kept it pretty simple when he was teaching the Kalamas. So, for example, what do you think, Kalamas? The Buddha says. When hatred arises in a person, is it for her welfare or for her harm? For her harm, Bhante. Kalamas, a person who is full of hate, overcome by hatred, with a mind obsessed by it, destroys life, takes what is not given, transgresses with another's spouse, speaks falsehoods, and encourages others to do likewise. would that lead to her suffering and harm for a long time? And they say yes, of course. So he repeats this for greed and delusion as well. And in all, I feel like he gives some pretty clear-cut examples of what greed, hatred, and delusion can lead to. They're not particularly subtle in this case. And he asks the people, if accepted and undertaken, will teachings that promote these actions lead to harm or suffering or not? Gauge it in your own experience. The people of the sutta, as I just read, they agree that the actions lead to harm and not welfare and suffering and not happiness. And then what makes me curious is, short of the more dramatic examples here, how do we do this in daily life? How do we act out of the understanding of the more subtle effects of greed, hatred, and delusion? And their opposites in our lives, in our minds and hearts. To explore this, I'm going to turn to another teaching, which the Buddha offered his, at the time, 7-year-old son, Rahula. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard this one as well. This is in the middle-length discourses. In this teaching, the Buddha talks about an alternative way of using the mind other than that list that I just read, the list of pairs, right? Rather than logic, intuition, or reasoning, the ways he said not to use, here he talks about having his son rely on reflection, that mirror-like capacity of the mind and heart. What do you think, Rahula? What is the purpose of a mirror? How would you address your dad if he was a famous teacher? For the purpose of reflection, venerable sir. Rahula, when you wish to do an action, and I'm going to condense here, with the body, with speech, or with the mind, you should reflect on that same action thus. Would this action I wish to do lead to my own affliction? That's also the same Pali word for suffering, by the way. To the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both self and other. Is it an unwholesome akusala, bodily action with painful consequences, with painful results? If when you reflect you know this, then you definitely should not do that action. This is to a 7-year-old. It's meant to be clean, concise, to the point. He repeats this not just for reflecting before an action, but for reflecting while doing an action, saying if an action leads to painful results, stop it. Just stop mid-action. Give it up. And reflecting after the action has been done. And in that case, if you discover, despite your best efforts, after an action's been done, that harm, suffering, pain is the result, I find it very interesting what he suggests Rahula do. He doesn't say, punish yourself. He doesn't say, criticize yourself. He says, take it to a wise friend or a teacher and talk about it. Lay it open, don't keep it secret. And then make the determination to refrain from doing that thing or things like it in the future. Isn't that gentle?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he also emphasizes, if when you reflect, you know this action I wish to do with my body, with speech, with my mind, does not lead to affliction of self or others, or affliction of both, but it's wholesome, with pleasant consequences, pleasant results, and benefit, then you may do such action. So this is a way of bringing our native intelligence to bear, right? Be mindful of consequences. But don't just be mindful of consequences for the purpose of beating yourself up. In fact, skip the beating yourself up part and be mindful of consequences for learning what to do in the future. I feel like the Buddha here offers a way of learning from ourselves and learning from the world around us as to ways, what ways of thinking and speaking and acting might hold us back, hold me back anyway, and what ways are skillful, lead to benefit, welfare, even happiness. He doesn't admonish his son to punish himself, as I mentioned, but rather he suggests revealing and restraint. Feedback. Some of you who listened to my talks before know that feedback, receiving feedback, is one of my primary spiritual practices, and it's a tough one. I see this as a way, this kind of loop that he's teaching, of letting life become our teacher. Anything can be our teacher. Anything. And it's also a way of noticing the impact of any greed, hatred, or delusion that might have been present in the mind, as well as the impact of any of their opposites. Non-greed is often considered to be the same as metta, loving kindness. Non-hatred, compassion. And non-delusion is clarity or wisdom. Can notice the impact of those too and be nourished by them when they occur. It might also be worth exploring the word reflection. Discursively thinking through the body's actions of body, speech, and mind before, during, and after may be all you got in daily life. That may be all that's available to us. So there's nothing wrong with using what we have available. And for that matter, bringing in the wise friends before, during, or after. However, the Buddha's use of reflection also implies a very non-discursive way that the mind-heart can operate. A kind of non-chatty, internal way of being that can see clearly, or at least see this broad fan of possibilities and the likelihood of which ones may or may not come to fruition. Many of you, I'm sure, have experienced this or some version of it on retreat or in a particularly good meditation. In my own experience, that mirror-like capacity or that seeing of potentiality is a very mature aspect of mindfulness. It's very closely related to wisdom. The gathering and development of wisdom, though, doesn't have to be any special state. To return to the Buddha's teaching, that he taught to the Kalamas, the Buddha suggests that people practice with cultivating the opposites of greed, hatred, and delusion. That is, cultivating what leads to welfare and happiness, to do it in their daily lives over and over again, to follow that. And he says in this same discourse that that sets people up for their minds, their hearts, and their communities to be in a different place. A place conducive to further levels of liberation, awakening, freedom. But perhaps because he was speaking to them as a circuit preacher, so to speak, one of many, many teachers who came through, to remember this multi-religious environment, right? The Buddha offers a particular form of practice that's not usually part of, or it's not associated with, the liberative teachings on emptiness and the Ticca Sammapada or dependent arising. Instead, He offers a practice that was very well known in the culture of ancient India. It exists in the pre-Hindu Brahmanical tradition, and so very well may have existed before Buddhism. It was something that Buddhism and Hinduism came to have in common, which is the teaching of the four immeasurables, otherwise known as the four Brahma Viharas. Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upekkha. In these early texts, these four kinds of love are considered to be four faces of the god Brahma. My understanding of Brahma is one translation is the all, the everything. I kind of consider them facets, faces of what's valuable within us and what's valuable between us. This benevolent loving kindness, compassion for difficulty, appreciative joy. What a beautiful emotion. Beats the heck out of envy. And upekkha, equanimity. So that's the teaching he offers them after talking about all of this cause and effect and all of this looking at greed and hatred and delusion. And how come you suppose he offered those other than the multi-religious aspect? Anybody have an idea?
They're easier.
They're easier? I'm sorry, someone else said something too.
Simple.
I think that is part of it. Yes, absolutely.
They're more heart qualities than all this. Seems like a lot of mental work here.
Yes. A little less mental heavy lifting and a little bit more in the heart. Absolutely.
They lead to connection and wholesomeness.
Lovely. They lead to connection and wholesomeness in a group of people that are kind of fed up. Might not be a bad thing to lead to, right? That's all great. I think all of those are absolutely true. They're definitely a way of encouraging a certain kind of social harmony. They're used that way in the discourses many times, actually. That's a whole other talk, so I'm not going to go there. But they also serve as aspirations, right? They're aspirations to this boundless quality of heart and mind. And they can certainly be expressions of the awakened heart and mind, too. I'm going to quote exactly what he taught them. So he encourages them to do it in daily life, and then he also encourages them to do it formally. Then Kalamas, one who is thus devoid of longing, devoid of ill will, unconfused and clearly comprehending, mindful, dwells, pervading one quarter of experience, with a mind imbued with loving kindness, pervades a second quarter, third quarter, and a fourth quarter. So all of heart and mind are suffused with loving kindness. He then repeats it, saying, dwells pervading one quarter, two quarters, three quarters, four quarters of the heart and mind with compassion, with altruistic joy as well, and with a mind imbued with equanimity. First quarter, the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth. Thus, above and below, across, around, and everywhere, as all is to themselves, they dwell, pervading the entire mind, entire world, with a mind imbued with equanimity, vast, exalted, measureless, without enmity and without ill will. Doesn't that sound beautiful? Nice way to be. that passage suggests, he emphasizes the formal cultivation of these four aspects of Buddhist love in our hearts. But it's worth noting that what he emphasizes beforehand is essentially a social practice of the same thing. There's many examples of metta as a social practice in the suttas and the commentaries. For example, there's a discourse in which the Buddha is wandering away, actually, from a sangha that's divided. I think the term that's used is they are striking each other with verbal daggers. And they're not listening to him. So he wanders off, checks in on a couple of other people, and then goes to a much smaller sangha. And the first thing he asks them, the head guy, Aniruddha, is, "Tell me, how are you getting along?" He says it in more sort of Victorian English than that, with this translation. And they each say to him, "We're blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." And they go on to describe every time each person might need something, all it takes is a nod or a look, and everyone pitches in to help. Or if the others aren't around, they anticipate and pitch in. And they say in that way, they dwell in great harmony. It's this really fertile field for their practice as a community. Big contrast to verbal daggers, right? There's others as well, but I'm going to use a more contemporary story to illustrate as well. I found the immeasurables very powerful practice in my own life. And this actually comes from someone who does not identify as a Buddhist at all, but has one of the most loving hearts I've ever encountered. And that's the poet Naomi Shihab Nye. Lovely being. And this is wandering around an Albuquerque airport terminal. It's not a poem. It's a short story. "After learning my flight was delayed 4 hours, I heard the announcement. If anybody in the vicinity of Gate 4A understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately." Well, one pauses these days. Gate 4A, though, was my own gate. I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumpled on the floor, wailing loudly. "Help," said the flight service person. "Talk to her. What is her problem?" We told her the flight was going to be 4 hours late, and she did this. I put my arm around her and spoke to her haltingly. I'm going to spare you my attempt at Arabic. But she speaks syllables and goes on to say, the moment she heard any words she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought our flight had been canceled entirely and she needed to be in El Paso for major medical treatment. I said, "No, we're fine. You'll get there. Just wait." "Who's picking you up?" "I'll call him and tell him." We called her son and spoke with him in English. I told him I'd stay with his mother until we got on the plane and would ride next to her, Southwest. She talked to him, and then we called her other sons, just for the fun of it. Then we called my dad, and she and he spoke for a while in Arabic and found out that, of course, they had 10 shared friends, too. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? That took all of about 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling about her life, answering questions. And she'd pulled out this sack of homemade mamoul cookies, little powdered sugar crumbly mounds stuffed with dates and nuts, out of her bag and was offering them to all of the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the traveler from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar and smiling. There are no better cookies. And then the airline broke out the free beverages from huge coolers, non-alcoholic. And two little girls for our flight, one African-American, one Mexican-American, ran around serving us all apple juice and lemonade, and they were covered with powdered sugar too. And I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing, with furry green leaves. Such an old country traveling tradition. Always carry a plant. Always be rooted somewhere. And I looked around that gate of late and weary ones and thought, this is the world I want to live in. The shared world. Not a single person in this gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, had seemed even slightly apprehensive about another person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all those other women too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost. That, to me, is one of the most beautiful modern stories of metta and compassion I've ever heard. It doesn't always have to happen on the cushion, right? You don't need a deep meditative state. It just takes that movement of the heart, that trust. And 4 hours stuck in an airport. So I use this in my work as a chaplain. If I am noticing or looking for loving kindness or friendliness, compassion, or altruistic joy, I tend to find them a lot more often than if I don't bother looking. The field is of tragedy often, of sadness and heartbreak, but these, like glimmering little shimmers in a dark pond, they also come up too. I'm also, if practicing this way as you would be or are, if I'm looking for and noticing kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity, it's really obvious when the opposites come up. Obvious and humbling. And just having them as being the background makes everything that's not them so much clearer. So to summarize, in these teachings, the Kalama Sutta and the Rahula Sutta, the Buddha offers several methods or compasses for discerning what teachings are worth taking up and which are not. In the process of doing so, he offers us powerful ways to cultivate our own inner wisdom when walking a path. While the Buddha encourages a certain kind of discernment or inquiry into this process, he didn't recommend deciding based on logic, reasoning, intuition, even pondering. Instead, he offered criteria, and I'm going to kind of clump the criteria. The first is do a gut check. Is this practice or teaching wholesome or unwholesome? The second, be mindful of context and culture and use your own internal reference points, fairness, a sense of integrity or kindness. Is it blameworthy or blameless? Is it censured or praised by those you respect as wise? What does your own wisdom tell you? Three, reflect on it. Use that mirror inside and notice the consequences. And I didn't write it here, but notice them with love and gentleness, not with the internal critic. Does something lead to harm or welfare, suffering or happiness? Reflecting before, during, and afterwards can be done using our full, discursive, chatty, amazing intellects, or a sublime mirror-like wisdom available in moments of lucidity that might even feel like moments of grace. The fourth compass is the four immeasurables, or any one of them. It's exactly in noticing them, as we were just talking about, noticing kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity, as well as their opposites, that the conditions are set for allowing these wholesome states and our own wisdom, your own wisdom, to increase. So from my perspective, if you use your gut, your mindfulness of context, noticing cause and consequences, and the greed, hate, and delusion that play into them, and you practice from a place of aspirational love, you are walking the path of wisdom. And life can become your teacher. Thank you very much for your kind attention. We have about 5 or 10 minutes for questions, comments, complaints, or additions, if anyone has any. Yes, back there.
I was just going to say...
One second, can you please wait for the mic?
Oh, sorry.
No, thank you.
I was just going to say that I personally use the word intuition for my gut feeling. So I was just wondering how that sat with other people, because when something's coursing through my body, and it's kind of a, you know, every fiber, say this, don't say that, do this, don't do that, or make an amends, that's my value system in my gut. I call it the wise woman in my gut.
Great.
And so I do use the word, this is not a big deal, but I do use the word intuition for that.
So I don't know if others have an opinion about this. For me, that's really just a semantic issue, perhaps.
Right.
I'm not really certain what Pali was translated to intuition, but it's probably dealing with something a little more heady and out there than it is when every fiber of your being says, no, don't do that. But I welcome other perspectives if people have it. We've got two up here. And if you could please, for my benefit, say your name.
I'm Mary.
Hi, Mary.
I was trying to think of examples currently of how one would assess, you know, using these criteria. And the one I think that comes up, that I run into most often is, should I turn on the news or not? And how much is good and how much is not good, and what, you know, what stations to watch or listen to or whatever. That's always a challenge, you know, of what's wholesome and what's unwholesome.
Right. And what the consequences are, right?
Mm-hmm. And what will make me nuts and what will, and what just informs me.
Yeah. So how do you go about that discernment for yourself?
For me, less and less. That's, you know, and less of that coming in, and more political action,
okay.
Just direct action itself, and less listening to ranting and writing.
Great. So your discernment is more action is required.
Mm-hmm. That makes me feel better.
Thank you for the comment and for the action. I think someone right in front of you had something too.
Thanks for your talk. My name's Meredith.
Hi, Meredith.
The thing that comes up for me about, you know, are you trustworthy? Is someone trustworthy? Dorian King was saying, like, what's happening here? Is to check stuff out with them. You know, if I'm confused or I feel hurt or angry. Mm-hmm. You know, is it me? Is it us? Is it what's happening? And a couple of times with teachers, that just throws me is it's all good. It just feels like a fog machine.
It just feels like a fog machine. Okay.
I don't, it's all good, like, okay, now what? And I haven't had the courage to go past that and say, well, it is, and, you know, so I'll just put that out there.
Yeah.
Because for me, someone who takes responsibility, including me, you know, for misunderstanding, to put it simply, that's where I can put my feet on the ground. So, and that was, I think, something else, but I forget what. Well, the whole political thing is, this isn't it, so I should probably not keep going, but it's just such an avoidance in so many ways for me.
Mm-hmm.
After this amount of time.
Yeah.
It's pretty predictable. Oh, I know what I was going to say, it is political. For me, having, I'm blanking his name, the elderly statesman, Joe Biden, went into the race. It's like shifting back and ground for me, breath of fresh air, remembering. Oh, yeah, I remember. Now, that has a lot to it, you know, I'm an age and blah, blah, blah. But I have a picture of Obama up for the in my room for the same reason. You know, it's like keeping what I want as in the foreground, and what I want in for the ground for me.
Yeah.
You know, and part of that's political, and part of it is health.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
It's healthy, and well, I could just keep talking, so I won't. So thank you.
Well, you had a question. Is healthy what?
Well, I get hung up in words like, anyway, the word wholesome and unwholesome from the 1950s, Dick and Jane, still sticks in my mind, and it's, you know, the Puritan mothers, and it's like, oh, spare me.
So maybe it's better for you to think of the alternate translation or just leave it in the Pali. So kusala and akusala also are often translated as skillful and unskillful.
Well, just to add to it, our conversation, often emotionally healthy goes a long way. You know, grounding, and you can go a long way with that. And for Ron Vita, thank you.
Appreciate it. I think there's someone behind you.
Oh. Struck by an action I took many years ago to vote for Proposition 13,
mm-hmm.
which seemed like a brilliant idea at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Limit taxes, live in your home. I didn't realize the long-term consequence was to squelch schools.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's difficult to know and can barricade or block action.
What can barricade or block action help?
Not knowing the long-term consequences.
Absolutely. Or it can lead to an action with, as you're describing, unintended consequences.
Right.
Yeah, and how do we be kind to ourselves?
How do we know?
We know from making a mistake by voting once, and then...
And then do you just sit down and say, okay, then I'm just not going to vote anymore. That was just really stupid.
Perhaps it leads to a deeper level of thinking about some of those decisions. And not, we don't always have time for that, right?
We don't. But anyway, it just, I want to put that out there, that we know only what we know.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't know the unknown unknowns, as one politician said.
Yeah, the unknowns.
Thank you. Burnett's getting her exercise up.
Kind of what you were talking about, you did something in retrospect that wasn't skillful. I love that at any point you can reflect, don't do this, or if you're doing it, stop doing this, or if you've done it, reflect on it and set your intention not to do it again.
Exactly.
So at any point you can, if you've got the time, and if the attention to what you're doing. But I find that very soothing, that even in the midst of doing something unskillful, there's a chance to just
And the other piece, which is revealing it to wise friends in the Dharma life, you just did.
Oh, I've done it over and over.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, like, the requirement isn't to flagellate oneself after a decision. It's just, as Linda was saying, you make a determination, not going to do that one again. It comes up. And let your companions hold it with you in compassion and respect.
It's not really a question. I just wanted to. I was just really struck by the Capuchin story.
Yes.
And it just made me start. And I think I have to give it more thought. I mean, I think it will prompt me to think about it a lot more. And fairness, the sense of fairness, where it comes from, whether it comes from this deep-rooted biological place, and how it's manifest and interpreted and understood in our society and distorted and tangled with entitlement and anger and envy and all these other things. Anyway, just, I thought that was really thought-provoking.
Thank you. There's a lot to say there, yeah. And a lot to consider, especially through the lens of privilege and generational trauma, and like there's so many factors that we can bring to bear. And I find it a little bit comforting that the roots of some of that, at least, are bigger than we are. The roots of an innate sense of fairness are go back deeper than this species goes back. There's something about that that I find strangely comforting. I encourage you to look up the YouTube video about the Capuchins, if you like. It's C-A-P-U-C-H-I-N, I believe.
Like cappuccino, and that study was just on television recently.
Was it?
Yeah,
okay.
It was funny. It was great.
Thank you. I don't have a TV, so I missed it.
Wise.
So thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you.